Well, I was 4 years old. It's hard to believe I was ever 4 years old, but I was. And I'm standing on the right corner of the front porch of the place that my older siblings call the old home place. It's the place where all nine of us were born, without a doctor, by the way, or running water or electricity, I might add. My mother was a strong woman. And I'm standing there watching the older siblings and my dad and mom. They had backed the big truck up, which was kind of a converted school bus, to be honest with you. They had backed it up to the front porch, and they were loading things on it. I mean, they started off with the bed frames, the big bed frames, with the big feather mattresses. Do you remember them? You could just, four-year-old child could just jump into one of them, and it would just swallow you as if you were in your mother's arms. And then, of course, the pillows, the feather pillows that my brothers and I had one sister and seven older brothers. And so if you want to know why I am the way I am, you know. And so we used to have these epic battles with those pillows. And then, of course, there was a small table in the hallway with the porcelain basin and pitcher where we used to wash our face and hands when coming in from the dusty outside. And then they loaded the wood-burning stove, that heavy cast iron stove, with the big reservoir on the side, the only source of heated water we had in our house. And then they loaded the dining room table, which was really just a picnic table with a long bench along the wall, and it was draped in a red and white checkered oilcloth, like the one you used to see at the checkered apron here in Macon years ago. You could still feel that texture, that kind of waxy texture on it, and smell that oilcloth. They put that on the truck too. Now, I should have suspected something because just a week earlier, they had brought another kind of truck, and they had loaded the mule. The two cows, the two pigs, the goat, my pet goat, the chickens, and of course that big black anvil that my dad kept by the smokehouse, the one that he beat metal into submission with when he was repairing one of the farming tools. They put that heavy thing on there too. I wished I had that thing today. And I stood there under the chineberry tree, under the apple tree in that particular house, under the apple tree, and I watched them do that. And I did not know what they were doing. But they put me on the truck and cranked it up, and we went about 3 miles down the road, turned left onto a dirt road, went about a mile, saw a mailbox, turned left at the mailbox, went about a quarter mile back into the woods, and we came upon another house that was kind of like the house we had just left. But I didn't know a thing about the Great Depression and the boll weevil and the drought and the crops and the cotton, and I didn't know that my father had lost the family farm and had to hire himself out to Mr. Harton, and that we would now be living in Mr. Harton's house for the sum total of a bale of cotton a year for rent. Tells you something about the nature of the house too. And so they put me out of the truck and they put me under the chineberry tree on the right corner of the back porch. This house had a back porch too. And they began to unload the truck, the bed frames, the feather mattresses and pillows, the porcelain basin and pitcher and the table in the hallway, the cast iron stove with the reservoir on the side, and then of course the big dining room table with the white, red and white checkered oilcloth. They unloaded all of that and put it in the house. And I stood there taking it all in, and I began to put two and two together as a four-year-old. And a tear welled up in my eyes. I remember it, my left eye, and it came down the side of my cheek. It was cold, and it caught the corner of my lip. And my bottom lip began to quiver, kind of an uncontrollable quiver. And then deep down inside my frame, there came this kind of primal, guttural utterance that made its way up to my lungs and out my mouth, and I shouted to the top of my four-year-old lungs, "I want to go home. I want to go home. I just want to go home." They tell me I disappeared for about 4 hours. And of course, in the country, they don't worry too much about you because there's not much you can do to hurt yourself. I mean, you can step on a rattlesnake occasionally or get caught up in a bramble bush, but for the most part, you're safe. But around noontime, my dad became a little concerned, so he got in that old truck and he headed back to the old home place thinking that his spunky little four-year-old son had taken off back there. And, don't put it past me. I could have done that, I think. My brother Milton and Gene and Thad, they fanned themselves out in the thicket trying to find me behind the house, thinking that I had wandered off. But later on that day, one of the older brothers, and I don't remember which one, whether it was Lawrence or Harold or Charles, I couldn't keep up with them all, but somebody found me. I had gone inside and climbed up on that bench along the wall, covered by the red and white checkered oilcloth, and I had cried myself to sleep. Because all I wanted to do was go home. Well, I've lived long enough now to come to understand that every one of us, all of us in this room, we all share some things in common, and we certainly share this in common. When you cut through the veneer of our lives and peel back the layers, at rock bottom, we're all just trying to find our place home, our way home. We're just trying to find our way home. To that place where we are loved and we can love. To that place where we are wanted. That place where we feel that we have a measure of security, a measure of hope. We're just trying to find that place where there is a sense of meaning and purpose in life. We're all just trying to find home. Now, this shouldn't come as a big surprise to us because you see it all the time in our literature, our music, our drama, our plays, our theater, our TV, our radio. It's everywhere if we will but listen. Some weeks ago, I'm preaching in Edison, Georgia, and in case you don't know, that's on the other side of the planet, down near Alabama and Florida. And I'm preaching in the small church there, and I'm coming back home late at night, and there are no street lights and no signs and no Starbucks. I mean, it's pretty desperate. And I'm heading toward Albany. It's about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock or so, and I'm just looking for civilization. And I cut the radio on. I just want to hear a voice, and I'm punching the AM dial. Now, I have a radio that only has an AM, FM dial. It doesn't have all this other stuff. And so I have to actually take my chances with public radio, and there it was. I landed upon Garrison Keillor in the Prairie Home Companion, and he was doing that little bit about the lives of the cowboys. You know, there are two main characters, Dusty and Lefty. They're just two cowhands making their way across the Midwest, trying to find hope and happiness. Every time we see them, they're usually around the campfire, the saddles are off the horses on the blanket, and they are looking up at the stars and talking about God and life and love. Occasionally they go into the city to talk to the girls at the cantina, and they order a sarsaparilla, that means they're Baptist. And, and so they come back to the campfire because you see, where they want to be is on the open range. That's their home. That's where they feel they belong. It's where they feel loved and they feel at peace with God and at one with each other in the world. You know that song that we used to sing as children, home, home on the range, where the deer and buffalo roam, where ne'er is heard a discouraging word and the sky is not cloudy all day. I tell you, if my mother were living today and she was standing here, she would tell you that that was what she thought of as home. I mean, how many times did I hear her say, you boys just get out of here. Leave me alone. I want to be alone. She wanted peace and quiet. That was her version of home. Now, for Miss Carrie, not quite so much. You remember Miss Carrie Ward, don't you, in the movie The Trip to Bountiful? If you've not seen that movie, I really encourage you to check it on Netflix. It's about 15 years old. The early version of it starred Geraldine Page. The later version is Cicely Tyson. They're similar, but different in some ways. But the early version has Geraldine Page playing this lady who lives in Houston, Texas, in a suburb. She lives with her son, whom she loves, and her daughter-in-law, whom she tolerates. And she has one thing she wants. Above all things, she wants to go back to a little town called Bountiful, Texas. But her children know some things, and they don't think she should go, and they delay her. They find all ways, the kind of ways to stop her from going. But she's smart. She saves up her Social Security check, and she finds her way there on a bus. But pretty soon, About 10 miles before she's to get there, the sheriff pulls the bus over and takes her off the bus at the request of the children. But the sheriff, in his wisdom, decides to take her the rest of the way. And so he drives off the road when he gets there, through the pastures, into the little area where the pecan grove is, where the houses are, kind of a semicircle of houses. And Miss Carey, for the first time, sees Bountiful after 50 years of being gone. The tree limbs are on top of the houses. The front porches are sagging. Nobody lives there. Everybody is dead and gone. The houses are about to fall in. The sheriff takes her and helps her up to the front porch of her own house. And she sits there and talks to him for a good long time about her memory of home. Her memory of home was a 1950s memory, a 1948 to 50s memory of home. In Bountiful, Texas, when everything was just great and everything was just fine. She wants to go back there. As I travel the state and talk to dozens of churches, I find that that is a good metaphor for us. Most of our congregations are sitting on the front porch of 1950, and they're wanting to go back. But what they don't understand and have to come to understand is that Bountiful is gone. And Miss Carey has got to come to grips with that. Now, for Dorothy, you remember Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz? Her sense of home was quite different. I mean, she lived in not a quiet, restful kind of place. She lived in a world of tumult. She was living with her adoptive parents, Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, and she just simply did not get along. At least she felt she didn't get along with the way things were. I mean, there was just tumult. And in fact, she actually had words with a neighbor down the street over her dog, Toto. And Dorothy was kind of a preteen living in a world of adolescence, trying to forge herself into adulthood. And it was as if a tornado had come into her existence and swept her off to a subconscious place, a place that we call Oz. And what happens when she gets to Oz? She meets three new friends: the lion, the tin man, the straw man. And what do they all have in common, all four of them? Well, they're trying to find their way home. They're all trying to find their way home. And they're told that the wizard knows the answer in the Emerald City, how to get them to home. And when they go there and meet him, well, they find out he's a charlatan. He can't even get himself home, much less somebody else. But the good witch tells Dorothy about clicking her heels, and she ends up back in Kansas. And what does she say when she gets back to Kansas?
There's no place like home.
Absolutely right. That's exactly right. And I will tell you, I have a lot in common with Dorothy because I live in a wonderful little neighborhood we call Hugoton Heights. And it's wonderful because Martha and Doodle live there too. And we have a great community. And I just love walking the sidewalks. I love the neighbors. I love watching people sip iced tea. I love watching people rock on the front porches. I mean, I tell you, if you ask me what my view of home is, it's that little neighborhood that we live in, where it's like, it's kind of like Mayberry with a few college students sprinkled in. It's just nice, and yeah, we do have our Bonnie Fifes as well that come through the neighborhood. It's a wonderful place, this place we call home. We're all in search of our place called home. You know, Thomas asked Jesus the question, how do we know the way? And Jesus tells him, I am the way. I have received a little help about this idea of finding our way home from an unlikely source. Her name is Kate Campbell. She's the daughter of a former prominent Baptist preacher. In fact, he was president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Jim Henry. Kate Campbell is in her mid-50s now, I would guess. She's a songwriter, lives in Nashville, has some wonderful albums. If you're not familiar with her, I encourage you to listen, especially if you like bluegrass, country, a little pop, some classical mixed in. No rap, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but her songs, she has the ability to take a common object in everyday life and see the face of God in it. I mean, she has songs like Jesus and Tomatoes Coming Soon. She has a song called Funeral Food. You just have to love that song, Funeral Food. But my favorite song, the one that has been the most helpful to me in understanding this whole issue of finding our way home, is one that she calls The Way Home. I want you to listen to the words of it. Have you ever been in the Richmond jail with no one there to go your bail? Well, if you've lost your way, it might help to know that Jesus is the way home. If you're trying to put that whiskey down and you realize you're losing ground, you don't have to walk that road alone, because Jesus is the way home. It doesn't matter where you're at or how you got there. He knows all that. Just let the good book be your map, because Jesus is the way home. Well, if life's not going like you planned and you feel that no one understands, there is a friend who will show you how to go. Jesus is the way home. It doesn't matter where you're at or how you got there. He knows all that. Just let the good book be your map, because Jesus is the way home. There is a garden down in Alabama, not too far south of Birmingham, painted signs and crosses by the road. One says, Jesus is the way home. So what is this little four-year-old boy that still dances inside of me? What has he learned all these years about this idea of finding home? Well, he's learned that the destination, as important as it is not the only thing. No. He's learned that what matters is the journey, this life we're given, this journey we're on. I mean, have you ever been going down the highway with your kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews, or and some kid in the back seat says, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Well, my kids did that one time, and I pulled the car over on the interstate and I rolled down the windows and said, yes, we are. We are right where we are. Look out the window and see the mountains, see the vistas, see the beauty, because we are always where we are. We're there already. Yes, this little four-year-old has learned that the destination, as important as it is, cannot obscure the fact that the journey matters. And what matters most about the journey is who we choose as our guide. Who shines the light in the dark places? Who picks us up when we fall? Who mends our broken heart? Who gives us hope for the future? Who we choose as our guide matters. It matters a lot, because in the choosing of our guide, we have a sense of purpose and direction and meaning. Miss Carrie is sitting on that front porch, talking to the sheriff, and she's having to come to terms that she can't live in the past, she's got to live in the future. That Bountiful, as wonderful as it was, is no more. And she's gonna have to find a way to make a life for herself in Houston, Texas, with her son and her daughter-in-law. She's gonna have to find a way to find a home there. And I think it's wonderful that as her son drives up in this family sedan in the last scene and goes over to the front porch and gets his mother gently by the hand and takes her back to the car. And the last scene, he drives off through the grass toward the highway. And guess what the director does of the movie? The Hollywood director, believe it or not, does this. He has the orchestra play a hymn. And it's the one we're going to sing in a few minutes. Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling. Calling us home, calling us home. See on the portals, he's waiting and watching, watching for you and for me. Come home, ye who are weary, come home. I tell you, this little four-year-old boy that's deep inside of me, he's not crying anymore, not those kind of tears. He's not angry anymore, not that kind of anger. And he is not afraid anymore, not that kind of fear, because he's come to understand that the destination, as important as it is no, it's got to be understood in light of the journey itself. And what matters about the journey is who you choose as your guide, who points the way, who picks you up, who restores your soul. There is a garden down in Alabama, not too far south of Birmingham, painted signs and crosses by the road. One says, Jesus is the way home. We're going to sing softly and tenderly now, and I ask your music leader to come and lead us as we worship together.